Hello and welcome to the magazine rack on Chris. I'm Mario Cajar, and today I'm reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. Up first, we have an article by Chris Mannix titled, Caitlin Clark Passes Diana Taurasi's Test in Phoenix. As much that is out there about the Caitlin Clark phenomena, about the record attendance numbers and skyrocketing TV ratings, about the flashy passing and limitless three-point range, you have to experience it in person to truly understand. There's a rare collection of stars in sports that just have it. LeBron James, Stephen Curry, Shohei Ohtani, and Patrick Mahomes. After 4 years of college basketball and a handful of games in the pros, it's clear that Caitlin Clark is one of them. This past Sunday, Clark was in Phoenix, her latest stop in her WNBA rookie tour. Hundreds of fans in Clark jerseys, some from Iowa, some from Indiana, walked the concourse while thousands more filled the seats. The roars picked up when Clark was introduced and were deafening when her first three-point shot, a running 29-footer from the Phoenix Mercury logo, dropped in. This was a home game for the Mercury, but let's be honest, most of the 17,071 fans in attendance bought tickets to see the Indiana Fever star play. There was a big game feel inside Footprint Center, and as regular season matchups go, it was one. Neither Indiana, with the record of 8-12, or Phoenix, 9-9, is a title contender. Well, not yet anyway, but that didn't matter. Basketball is a team sport, but its popularity is built around individuals. It was Fever versus Mercury, but really it was Clark versus Diana Taurasi, the greatest women's basketball player of all time, versus the woman who could someday supplant her. And that game delivered. 6 lead changes, 4 ties. The Mercury led by as many as 15 in the first half. In the third quarter, the Fever got their lead as high as 10. Taurasi scored 19 points. Clark collected 15. While Clark's shot, 4-14, wasn't falling, she made an impact with her playmaking, 12 assists, and on the glass, 9 rebounds, playing nearly the full 40 minutes while battling an illness that kept her from addressing reporters after the game. In the fourth quarter, with Indiana clinging to a 1-point lead, Clark knocked down 2 free throws with 19 seconds left to seal the win for the Fever. It's amazing what Caitlin's been able to do in her short career, said Taurasi. So far, it's just been nothing short of remarkable. Taurasi sparked a social media stir last week, answering a question about facing Clark with a terse, "Yeah, it'll be fun." The veteran had a similarly chilling warning for Clark back in April before the NCAA title game, telling ESPN's Scott Van Pelt, and I quote, "Reality is coming. You look superhuman playing against some 18-year-olds, but you're going to come play with some grown women that have been playing professional basketball for a long time," end quote. Though the league's spike in popularity has everything to do with Clark, she hasn't exactly been welcomed with open arms. And as she prepared for a Taurasi-led Mercury team, it was fair to wonder if she would face more of the same. Instead, there was nothing but smiles between two of women's basketball's most recognizable faces. They hugged before the game, exchanging a laugh before the opening tip. In the first half, they met near center court during a break in the action, talking for over a minute before play resumed. And as little as Taurasi had to say about Clark before the game, she had plenty to say after. "The one thing that I really love about her, she loves the game," said Taurasi. "You can tell she's put the work in. And even throughout her short WNBA career, it's been a lot of pressure, a lot of things thrown at her, and she keeps showing up and keeps getting better every single game. There is pressure, but make no mistake, Clark was built for this. At 22, she has the maturity of a decades-long pro, batting away loaded questions as effortlessly as she does jump shots. Knocked down by Chenity Carter? Basketball's competitive," said Clark. "Left off the U.S. Olympic team? Hey, just gives you something to work for," said Clark. Ahead of Clark being drafted, Taurasi said she was in for a reality check. before Sunday's game, Clark referred to Taurasi as one of her idols. "I just admired the way she played the game and the fire that she played with," said Clark. "It's impressive that she's still able to play this game at such a high level and produce the way she does. It's incredible. I think she's obviously the best scorer our game has ever seen and one of the best players our game has ever seen." Taurasi, 42, has a two-decade head start on Clark, but it may not be long before she's chasing those labels. Clark's shooting gets the attention, but her playmaking sets her apart. Slip passes, bounce passes, long leads up the floor. She's Pete Maravich with a ponytail. Clark averages 5.6 turnovers per game, but many of them have bounced off the hands of teammates that don't see them coming. "You just have to be ready," said Fever forward Aaliyah Boston. "And I think sometimes, too, when she's getting blitzed as much as she does, she'll find a way to make those passes. So just making sure that we're in her spaces, and then especially in transition, she's looking to get the ball out, looking to push, and so we have to just keep running." Caitlin Clark didn't build the WNBA, but Sunday's game is further evidence that she is supercharging it. The foundation that was laid by Taurasi and Tamika Catchings, Cynthia Cooper, and Maya Moore now has the kind of shooter the women's game has never seen to add on to it. Just like Curry spawned a generation of long-range shooters in the men's game, Clark can do the same for the women. "What she's done nationally for the game has been pretty incredible," said Taurasi. "Her future is super bright. Being a veteran and being in this league for a long, long time, it's pretty cool to see that and going into the future." Indeed. As Clark finished a post-game interview, thousands of fans stuck around to cheer her off the floor. She smiled, waved, and signed a few autographs before disappearing down a tunnel. The trip to Phoenix was a success. Another city is waiting. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now here's an article by Tom Verducci titled, "Picking MLB First-Time All-Stars. Red Sox, Padres Standouts Lead the Way." Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, Shohei Ohtani, Bryce Harper. You know the All-Star game locks. What makes the game so fascinating are the first-time All-Stars. Their journeys cover everything from announcing their arrival on the national stage for the start of an era, Adley Rutschman, 25 years old last year, to hotshot rookies, Corbin Carroll, 22, to the oldest first-timer who turned out to be the game's MVP, Elias Diaz, 32. There were 33 first-time All-Stars last season. The record is 42 first-timers in 2021, a record that could be challenged this year as the game increasingly is owned by younger players and as the injured list fills up. Anybody can pick an obvious All-Star. The fun is identifying the breakout and the breakthrough players, young and old, that could be in Arlington, Texas for the game on July 16th. So, here you go. All-star teams made up entirely of players looking for their first Midsummer Classic selection. By the way, here's a note. The statistics are up to date heading into games on July 1st, 2024. First, for the American League. Catcher, Connor Wong, Red Sox, age 28. The former Houston University shortstop gets the nod in a close race over Ryan Jeffers of the Twins and Cal Raleigh of the Mariners. Among AL catchers, only Rutschman of the Orioles has a higher WAR and a higher OPS plus than Wong. Telling stat, Wong has a .908 OPS away from Fenway Park. At first base, Josh Naylor, Guardians, 27. Winning a close call over Ryan Mountcastle of the Orioles, Naylor leads the AL first baseman in home runs, RBIs, and slugging. His 20 homers tie a career high. Telling stat, only two Cleveland first basemen have hit 35 homers. Those are Hal Troske and Jim Thome. At second base, Jordan Westberg, Orioles, age 25. Westberg has played more games at third base, 54, than at second base, 33, but he has enough innings at second to get the nod over another multi-position infielder, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa of the Blue Jays. Telling stat, Westberg has 24 two-strike RBIs. Only Jose Ramirez and Judge have more in the AL. Playing shortstop, Gunnar Henderson, Orioles, age 23. It's hard not to pick Bobby Witt Jr. out of the Royals, but the choice is clear. That's how good Henderson has been. He leads all AL shortstops in home runs at 26, RBIs at 58, and total bases 197, and WAR 6.1. Telling stat, in his first 265 career games, Henderson reached 58 homers, 24 steals, and 522 total bases. Only three others reached those thresholds that quickly: Fernando Tatis Jr., Ronald Acuna Jr., and Ryan Brown. At third base, Josh Smith, Rangers, 26. What an amazing breakout year for Smith, who was seized his opportunity due to injuries with Texas infielders. A career 191 hitter entering this season, he leads AL third baseman in WAR. He also has started 14 games at shortstop. Telling stat, Smith is hitting 500, 23 for 46, and slugging 826 when he puts the first pitch into play. In the outfield, Jaron Duran, Red Sox, 27. Only Aaron Judge and Soto have a higher WAR among AL outfielders than Duran, who leads the league in doubles at 23 and triples at 10. No one has done that since Cesar Tovar in 1970. His telling stat, Duran is on pace for a 40-40-20 season, doubles, steals, and triples. That's been done only five times, and not at all since Kiki Kyler in 1925. Outfield, Riley Green, Detroit Tigers, 23. An all-field hitter with patience, Green has a steady, almost slump-proof approach and swing path at the plate. Telling stat, over the past 2 years, Green has popped out only six times, the fewest of any hitter who has seen 3,000 or more pitches. Outfield, Stephen Kwan, Guardians, age 26. It's always been a joy to watch Kwan defend in the outfield, run the bases, and put the ball in play. This year he has added more pop with a 535 slugging percentage. The last qualified hitter in a full season to slug 500 with less than 50 strikeouts was Albert Pujols in 2006, and Kwan may very well achieve that this season. His telling stat, Kwan has seen 367 fastballs in the zone. He has swung and missed at only two of them. Starting pitcher, Tanner Houck, Red Sox, 28. Houck is among the league leaders in ERA, ERA+, FIP, and home run rate. He has obtained at least 17 outs in 16 of his 17 starts. He has been so efficient in providing that consistent length that he has only walked 17 batters while throwing 100 pitches just three times. His telling stat, including cutters, Houck has only thrown 33.1% fastballs, the lowest percentage among the 120 pitchers with 1,000 pitches. And the relief pitcher, Mason Miller, A's, 25. An outlier even in this age of high velocity, Miller is striking out 47% of the batters he faces while allowing just a 1.32 batting average. His telling stat, he has thrown 265 pitches clocked at 100 miles an hour or more, 109 more than anyone else, and 93 more than any other team. And now, the National League lineup. First, catcher, Patrick Bailey, Giants, 25. Bailey has always been a premier receiver. He ranks second among catchers in pop time and framing. This year, he has blossomed into a solid hitter, improving his strikeout and walk rates and exit velocity by wide margins. His telling stat, Bailey has the highest percentage of batted balls hit in the launch angle sweet spot in MLB. That's 45.4% between 8 and 32 degrees, minimum 150 batted balls. At first base, Christian Walker, Diamondbacks, 33. Nobody on these first-time All-Star teams has waited longer. Waived by the Orioles, Braves, and Reds, Walker didn't become an everyday player until age 28, and that was in 2019. Since then, he has won two Gold Gloves and hit the sixth most home runs among all first basemen. His telling stat, Walker has 60 barrels this season, the sixth most in MLB. At second base, Brian Turang, Brewers, 24. A .218 hitter last year, Turang is one of the most improved players in baseball, hitting .292 this season. He has also stolen 28 bases in 32 attempts. Telling stat, Turang is a .265 hitter with two strikes. In the NL, only Luis Arraez is better. At shortstop, C.J. Abrams, Nationals, 23. It's close, but Abrams gets the nod over Eli De La Cruz of the Reds. Abrams edges De La Cruz in WAR, OPS, OPS+, RBI, hits, and total bases. His telling stat, Abrams is the best fastball hitter in Major League Baseball at .372. Third base, Ryan McMahon, Rockies, 29. Only Matt Chapman has a higher WAR among NL third basemen. And for teams interested in trading for McMahon, his home-slash-road OPS splits are appealing, not concerning. .827 at home at Coors Field versus .798 on the road, and he hits left-handed pitching, .323. McMahon hits .253 with the bases empty and .296 with the bases occupied. Oddly, he sees more four-seamers than any other hitter, 43.4%, while hitting .271 against them. Telling stat, the sweet-swinging McMahon has hit only three pop-ups this year. Outfield, Jurickson Profar, Padres, 31. It's been a strange career arc. Profar, once a top-hitting prospect, has bounced from the Rangers to the A's to the Padres to the Rockies, and then back to the Padres. He didn't sign this year until February 24th, and suddenly he is an on-base machine who is hitting the ball harder than ever before in his life. His telling stat, his average exit velocity has jumped from 86.5 miles per hour last year to 90.4, the biggest jump in MLB. Outfielder, Jackson Merrill, Padres, 21. The rookie is tied for fifth among NL outfielders in homers, sixth in hits, and eighth in total bases. He's the youngest player on these first-time All-Star teams. Telling stat, Merrill ranks in the 90th percentile in arm strength, expected slugging, and base running. Only one other player has such a skill set, fellow rookie Colton Cowser of Baltimore. Outfielder Brandon Nimmo, Mets, 31. Where have all these sluggers gone? National League outfielders are slugging .382, the lowest since the mound was lowered in 1969. With 13 home runs, Nimmo has more homers than any National League outfielder except Teoscar Hernandez, Tatis, and Brian Reynolds. His slash numbers are down from last year, but he's good enough to get a spot here. Telling stat, because he lets the ball travel so deep, Nimmo sees a ton of fastballs at 54.1%, ninth most, not including cutters, and doesn't do much with them, .221. He's better off against off-speed and spin at .263. And the starting pitcher, Ranger Suarez, Phillies, 28. In 16 starts, Suarez is 10-2 with a league-leading 2.27 ERA and a strikeout-to-walk rate of 4.71-1. If the Philly ace is able to get those numbers back to an ERA below 2.0 and a 5-1 strikeout-to-walk rate, he would join quite the elite club. Since Sandy Koufax in 1963, only six qualified pitchers in a full season posted a sub 2.00 ERA with five times as many strikeouts as walks. Greg Maddux, Pedro Martinez, Clayton Kershaw, Zach Greinke, Jacob deGrom, and Justin Verlander. Telling stat, until giving up a home run to the Marlins' Brian De La Cruz this past Sunday, Suarez had not allowed a long ball on a four-seamer since September 3rd of last year. His command on the pitch is so good that batters barely hit above 200 against it over that span. And the relief pitcher, Robert Suarez, Padres, 33. Suarez was working construction and playing semi-pro ball in Venezuela when a buddy suggested the Mexican League paid decent money. So, in 2015, at age 24, he became a professional for the first time. He pitched in Mexico and Japan before, at age 31, he signed with his first major league organization, the Padres. Rewarded last year with a 3-year, $30 million deal, Suarez has become a bargain. And his telling stat, Suarez has thrown 78% four-seam fastballs, and batters are hitting 165 against them. This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. From baseball, we go to football, with this article by Connor Orr titled, Predicting Six New NFL Playoff Teams for 2024 with the Teams They'll Replace. Each NFL season, we get about six new playoff teams, with the Kansas City Chiefs rising around the time of the New England Patriots' demise. We still have that relatively automatic, set-in-stone team that takes away a bit of the postseason's mystery. Still, like we do every year, I wanted to take a crack at guessing which six teams we might be looking at as playoff newcomers in January. This year, in order to make the exercise a little bit more complicated, I wanted to include which team will fall out of the playoff bracket as a result of the new entry. One thought that immediately came to mind, I see the NFC as far less fungible than the AFC. That's not a total surprise. Last year, the AFC had a quarterbacking murderer's row, only to lose a majority of the best players over the course of a few weeks, or a few plays. So it's natural that there's some resettling taking place if those quarterbacks, notably Joe Burrow and Aaron Rodgers, stay healthy. It's easy to say that Team X has improved in the offseason, but I am a believer in keeping it real. Okay then, which team didn't? There are plenty of happy, feel-good projectors out there, but when I pick team records, I pick every single game because not every club can go 11-6. So, with that in mind, let's take a look at this season's playoff newbies. First, the New York Jets, at the expense of the Miami Dolphins. Why? This Jets defense is incredibly deep, and you can't say it doesn't matter because it didn't seem to last year when Rodgers was hurt and the defense was responsible for controlling games. However, there's some selective memory at play. The Jets stuck it to Kansas City last year and beat a humming Philadelphia Eagles team before Philly's own collapse. If Rodgers gets injured again, there would be far more optimism internally that a quarterback such as Tyrod Taylor can win some tight games and, in the process, understand what it takes to lift the franchise emotionally. Meanwhile, Miami scares me. This offense wears down over the course of long seasons, and its 4x100 track team is almost never as effective in December and January. Paying or not paying Tua Tagovailoa complicates life, and one has to wonder whether the defense can markedly improve without DC Vic Fangio. I think even if Taylor was the Jets' projected starter, I would like the team's depth and makeup slightly better than that of the Dolphins going into 2024. It's true we don't know what Rodgers is going to look like after his Achilles tear in 23 and his mediocre injury plague 2022, but we know this team's floor. The Jets have been better than most have given them credit for, despite some absolutely gruesome luck when it comes to injuries. Next, the Los Angeles Chargers, at the expense of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Why? While I'm as curious as anyone as to how Greg Roman's offense suits Justin Herbert, a QB you certainly wouldn't want involved intricately in the running game, there's no doubt the Chargers upgraded a team and got tougher across the board this offseason. LA starts the season with three very winnable games against the Las Vegas Raiders, Carolina Panthers and Steelers, not to mention the New Orleans Saints, Denver Broncos, and Arizona Cardinals coming off an early bye. Only that Chiefs game in Week 4 looks perilous. The rest are all winnable. And let's say the Chargers find some momentum early. They end the season with games against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Broncos, Raiders, and Patriots. What are the chances that three of those four teams have a losing record by the time L.A. gets them? What are the chances that all four of those teams have a losing record? I think we underrate scheduling as it pertains to these supposed rising teams, only to see the teams with a generous schedule get their comeuppance a year later. The Steelers got better this offseason without question, but we go back to an issue of scheduling. Mike Tomlin's teams will never be bad, but he gets the meat of the hardest division in football through the waning months of the season. With a physical veteran team, that can be a tough risk. Next, the Indianapolis Colts, at the expense of the Houston Texans. Why? The Colts and Texans opened the season against each other, which should give us a good idea of how evenly matched these teams are when both feature a healthy quarterback. Last year, Houston's season was a breath of fresh air and featured some truly inspired play from C.J. Stroud. That can be true alongside the fact that the Texans' victories were against Joe Flacco, Gardner Minshew, Ryan Tannehill, Will Levis in overtime, Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray in his second game back from a torn ACL, Joe Burrow, Baker Mayfield, Derek Carr, Kenny Pickett and Mitch Trubisky, and Trevor Lawrence. Meanwhile, the Colts took a good L.A. Rams team into overtime and beat the Baltimore Ravens in overtime, while still having the services of Anthony Richardson. That's certainly a small sample size, but why aren't we talking more about the fact that just one game separated these two teams and that the Colts scored 19 more points than the Texans did a year ago? Next come the Cincinnati Bengals at the expense of the Cleveland Browns. Why? For the Bengals, just like the Jets, having a team that was competitive and scrappy in the absence of its star quarterback is a tantalizing prospect and makes them an easy candidate for a rebound season. I saw some ESPN pundits arguing that Burrow could have a similar arc to Carson Wentz, with a complete change in perception occurring right after a trip to the Super Bowl. I disagree, given that the Bengals' offense is Burrow. He runs it like Peyton Manning. He may have more control over the particulars of his offense than any of the young quarterbacks currently dominating the landscape. And Wentz's problems weren't really injury-related as much as they were an accumulation of bad habits and an increasing number of teams preparing for an offense that featured the kind of RPO game Wentz was good at. Burrow's back injury has not been great, but his ceiling as a player is infinitely higher than Wentz's ever was. The Bengals are a Super Bowl contender every year he steps on the field at peak health. Also, I'm not picking on the Browns, but they've just lost their top position coach, who headed the second most important unit on the team, OL coach Bill Callahan, who left to join his son's staff in Tennessee. We still don't know what Deshaun Watson can be outside of one promising game against the Titans and one promising half against the Ravens. I think Cleveland is depending on a lot of what-ifs. What if Watson is really good? What if Nick Chubb can come back from a devastating injury? What if Jerry Jeudy figures it out? What if Myles Garrett ages beautifully? What if teams don't pick up on Jim Schwartz in year two? Meanwhile, they play in the toughest division in football. One can argue the Ravens didn't clearly upgrade this offense, but that doesn't make them any easier to beat. Cleveland walloped a clearly ailing Joe Burrow in Week 1 last season and lost to Jake Browning later on in the year. The team went 1-1 against the Steelers and 1-1 against the Ravens. Are we confident that they will be able to gain any ground in 2024? If we had to pick between Cleveland's roster and Cincinnati's, assuming everyone is healthy, isn't it hard to look at Burrow at his best, this Bengals defense at its best, the team's skilled position players at their best and say that we don't like the Bengals just a little bit more? And that'll do it for this installment of the magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.